From NPR and WVUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Susan Rice served as a trusted senior aide to President Obama, as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and then as National Security Advisor. Her voice was one of the most influential in guiding the president on foreign policy and national security matters. She joined Obama's campaign in its earliest stages and then stayed in the administration until his final day in office. Her face was attached by her political opponents to the Benghazi debacle, but her fingerprints could be found in policies affecting countries spanning the globe. In her new memoir, Tough Love, Susan Rice recounts her side of the story, as well as her own story, as the daughter of a Jamaican immigrant, the descendant of slaves, and as a woman who constantly felt she had to prove herself. We'll talk about crises personal and political, past and present. This hour on Point, my conversation with Susan Rice. Join us for those who want to understand national security matters under President Obama or the present day. What questions do you have for my guest? And what current day matters would you like her take on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. As I said, with us from Washington, D.C., from NPR's headquarters in the nation's capital, Susan Rice. She was National Security Advisor from 2013 to 2017, and prior to that, she served as Obama's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She's author of the new memoir, Tough Love, My Story of Things Worth Fighting For. Currently, Rice is a distinguished visiting research fellow at American University School of International Service and a non-resident senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. All of that attribution could not possibly even fit on a tweet. Susan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.
So let's talk, if we can, just for a moment about the present day. Last Sunday night, President Trump announced that U.S. troops would be departing from northern Syria. Within 72 hours of the withdrawal of American forces from that region, Turkish forces moved into the area and attacked our Kurdish allies who have been fighting ISIS there. Here's CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward reporting from northern Syria on Wednesday.
What we saw was this just overwhelming wave of civilians trying desperately to get out of this town, fearful for their lives. The streets choked with traffic, cars with mattresses strapped to roofs, women, children in the back of flatbed trucks. I approached some of them and asked them where they were going, and they told me simply, Brianna, we don't know where we're going. We don't know where it's safe. They have no sense of the scope and scale of this Turkish operation.
Susan Rice, tell us what your, you know, expert thoughts on this Turkish operation. Tell us what it means for the region and what it means for American leadership there.
Well, obviously, what we just heard from that report is that there's a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding, one, unfortunately, of the United States making, but we also have a strategic catastrophe unfolding. The Kurds, as you mentioned, were the pointy end of the spear in our effort to defeat ISIS. They, 11,000 Kurdish fighters, men and women, gave their lives in the fight to contain and defeat ISIS. We did this in a different way than in the past, David, rather than putting tens of thousands of U.S. forces on the ground as we did in Afghanistan or in Iraq to fight terrorism. It was actually President Obama during his administration that crafted a new way of fighting terrorism, where we partner with local forces. And the United States' role is to provide training, advice, and assistance to those local fighters who take the fight to the terrorists. And the Kurds did that extremely ably on our behalf. So now we have abandoned them. We have left them to the wolves, and the wolves being the Turks, who view them as terrorists and aim to destroy them. These innocent civilians that we just heard from that are suffering the extraordinary consequences of this are the most proximate victims. But understand the consequences of this strategically. It means that in the future, when we look to have to fight terrorists, they're not going to be partners who trust in us again and who are willing to do the bulk of the fighting for us. We've betrayed them, and so why would anybody do it? That means that U.S. forces are more likely to have to take the fight to the terrorists themselves directly. It also means that allies around the world, whether in Europe or Asia or the Middle East, have great reason to question U.S. constancy and our commitment to our allies and partners. Mm-hmm. And finally, and most worryingly in some respects, the Kurds had a chokehold on ISIS in northern Syria. They were holding 10,000 ISIS prisoners who are terrorists. If let out or escape, they will do enormous damage to us and our partners around the world. And they were helping us to contain the remnants of ISIS. Now that they have to defend themselves against the Turks with no help from us, their ability to keep ISIS under wraps is absolutely eliminated. So this is a real strategic catastrophe as well as a humanitarian one.
I think it's worth pointing out, and you write a bit about it in your book, you know, if people think about Syria in the Obama years, that was a point of great frustration for the administration. In August 2012, President Obama had asserted that the use of chemical weapons by Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria on his own people there would likely trigger the use of U.S. military action.
We have communicated in no uncertain terms with every player in the region that that's a red line for us, and that there would be enormous consequences if we start seeing movement on the chemical weapons front or the use of chemical weapons. That would change my calculations significantly.
Susan Rice, a year later, Syrian forces end up killing more than 1,400 people with sarin gas, and the U.S. did not intervene militarily. What contributed to that decision, and what lessons do you draw from what played out there?
Well, David, this is something that I write about at length in Tough Love, and there are really three different fights, so to speak, that were going on in Syria. And the first one is the one that we were just talking about, the fight against ISIS. That is the one that President Obama initiated in 2014 when ISIS resurged in both Iraq and Syria and continued to prosecute that fight against ISIS through the end of his administration, and President Trump took it up subsequently, and we are where we are today. That's the first fight. The second fight was the Syrian civil war, where Bashar al-Assad, the dictator in Syria, was trying to crush the uprising that arose in 2011 and continues in much diminished form to this day. That fight, President Obama made a decision we would not directly intervene in militarily, and rather we would provide support to the opposition. We would provide substantial humanitarian assistance. We would work diplomatically to try to resolve that conflict. The third fight really was over the use of chemical weapons, and that's what President Obama in that take you were playing referred to. In 2013, as you said, and as many listeners will recall, the Assad regime did use sarin gas and killed an estimated 1,400 people at Ghouta. President Obama decided that he would respond by striking targets in Syria related to their chemical weapons infrastructure. But before he did, he ultimately chose to seek congressional authority for that, congressional authorization, because he believe that this fight could extend beyond a handful of limited strikes. It could potentially lead to us becoming more deeply embroiled in Syria, as I write in the book, and he wanted congressional support for that. That support was not ultimately forthcoming. And as a result, the president didn't strike militarily, but instead chose to work a deal with the Russians to put pressure on the Syrian regime to declare its chemical weapons stockpile and give it up and have it destroyed. So 1,300 metric tons of chemical weapons were removed from Syria and disposed of and destroyed. That was an important achievement. But then years later, in 2017 and 2018, when President Trump was in office, there was again use of both chlorine and, we believe, sarin gas. So either the Syrians kept some back that they didn't declare and destroy, or they made some new gas in the interim. President Trump made the decision to use force, basically took literally the targets that the Obama administration had identified, pulled them off the shelf, and struck one night in 2017 and one night in 2018. But interestingly, there was no diplomatic follow-up and no effort thereafter to prevent the subsequent use of chemical weapons. So whatever weapons were there in 2017 and 2018 at least are still there today. So we see the benefits of striking. It made us feel good. It reinforced a statement of a declaratory statement, but it did nothing to address the chemical weapons challenge. Diplomacy, in fact, in 13 did help address the chemical weapons challenge.
Ambassador Rice, we only have about a minute and a half left before our break on our first segment. But I wanted to – you raised the question of President Trump. I want to talk to you very – sketch out a little bit at the current moment. Obviously, President Trump embroiled an impeachment inquiry over his pressuring of the Ukrainian leader. As somebody who's been at the highest level thinking about national security, international diplomacy, what do you make of that interaction? Does it rise to that level of scrutiny?
It's quite extraordinary and it's quite dangerous. What President Trump has done with Ukraine and also with China is to use his influence in the case of Ukraine to the withholding of almost $400 million in military aid and a White House visit. In the case of China, the leverage that we have in our current trade conflict to try to extort out of both these countries dirt and false information that he can use against his political opponent, Joe Biden. Never that I know of in the past in administrations, Democratic or Republican, have the President of the United States utilized the weight of the office for his own personal political benefit, and maybe in some cases financial benefit, rather than the interests of the United States government. So this is an extraordinary development that definitely bears inquiry.
We're discussing America's global standing, foreign policy, and much more with the former National Security Advisor to the United States. That's Susan Rice. You can join the conversation. What role do you believe the U.S. should play in the 21st century on a global stage? What factors should go into the use of force abroad? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the turbulent state of the U.S., authority around the world, with the former National Security Advisor for the United States. And we're also talking about her life history. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for Susan Rice? What global crises facing the U.S. do you have questions about? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, again, Susan Rice. Her new memoir is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Susan, we're going to take a couple of quick calls first. Got a call first from Atlanta, Georgia. David, thanks for listening. What's your thoughts for Susan Rice?
Hi, David. Hi, Susan. This is David Cornwell. I actually
hi, David
have a
Cornwell.
Comment. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, fantastic.
So we should
sometimes
tell
On
the
Point
audience.
Turns into this is your life, right, David?
This is definitely my life. I grew up two houses away from David Cornwell in Washington, D.C.
Huh.
And his family and my family have known each other forever.
Forever. And so, David, I actually don't have a question. I have a comment.
Yes,
that
sir.
I want your listeners to know who your guest is. She was an extraordinary young girl, young lady, and an extraordinary woman. The combination of grace and strength you've never seen before. We grew up in Washington, D.C. in a predominantly black neighborhood where excellence was expected. Whether in backyard cookouts, sitting in the kitchen, or when we went to our schools, achievement was expected, but nobody could have imagined achievement at the level that Susan has. And so I say to 45, when you say patriot, you're saying Susan. When you're saying leader, you're saying Susan. And we're all proud of you, Susan. Your book tour is an opportunity to express what we've known for years about you. And I hope the listeners and all across the nation will take it to heart. This is what a patriot looks like.
David, that's so wonderful. Thank you so much. You're going to make me cry here. That's
Thanks.
Incredibly generous.
Thanks for that testimony, David. We appreciate it. Let's take a moment and talk about the personal qualities and also the childhood a little bit of Susan Rice. In 2013, President Obama named Susan Rice as his national security advisor. In an event announcing her appointment, he cited a few of what he said were her defining qualities.
She is fearless. She is tough. She has a great tennis game and a pretty good basketball game. Her brother's here, who I play with occasionally, and it runs in the family, throwing the occasional elbow, but hitting the big shot.
So, Susan Rice, let's talk for a moment about those elbows. You write about growing up at first in Maine and then in D.C. You write about being the daughter on the one hand of a Jamaican immigrant, on the other the descendant of slaves, American slaves. And you also write about being a child of a very unhappy marriage and ultimately of divorce in your family. What did you really talk a bit about what this did to you as a person? And from a pretty young age, right, from the age, I think, of 6, 7 on, you were playing a distinctive role in your family.
Yes, David. I actually was born and raised in Washington, D.C. My mother was from Maine, and I spent a lot of my time in summers up there. Our caller, David Cornwell, will attest and knew my family well. I had extraordinary parents who were very accomplished professionals. My father rose to become a governor of the Federal Reserve. My mother was a corporate executive who sat on 11 boards and was instrumental
in establishing.
I mean, they
set an extraordinary standard for you guys, it seems like, in terms of professional achievement.
The expectations were high. And my mom helped establish the Pell Grant program that has enabled 80 million Americans to go to college. So they were extraordinary, but they had a terrible marriage. And that marriage began to fall apart when I was about 6 or 7, and my brother was 2 years younger than me. And it was a very contentious, ugly atmosphere. Lots of screaming and yelling, lots of fighting, some throwing of objects. It was a terrifying thing for me and my younger brother to have to live through. And I felt I had no choice but often to intervene and to try to calm the situation, stop them from fighting, even listen to both sides and try to diffuse the argument and mediate. And it was a searing experience that frankly lasted many years, because it was a while before they separated. And then they experienced a very long, drawn-out divorce and custody battle, which became public in many respects. So what that experience did for me, on the one hand, it was, you know, searing and brutally painful and terrifying. On the other hand, what it made me realize is that, you know, I can survive. I can get through a difficult experience and still come out of it intact. And, you know, it affected me. It affected my friendships. It affected relationships that I later had, you know, in my commitment, my fears about commitment to marriage. But I came out of it knowing that I could take a hit and keep running. And that was a very important lesson for me, that I had in me something that enabled me to be resilient. It also taught me that, you know, something that I didn't know I'd need later in life, which is negotiating and mediating skills, which a kid that age shouldn't have to employ. But I think I learned early on about running into fires and trying to help put them out.
It's funny, because there's this tension you write about as you sort of a young professional. You served, you know, I talk about Obama. You served early on in the Clinton administration as well. You know, were accomplished there as well. And yet there was a moment at which a mentor, I think Howard Wolpe, took you aside.
Yes.
Wolpe, excuse me, and took you aside, I think here on page 191 or so, and basically said, hey, you're being too brash. You know your stuff. You are so smart, and your decisions may be good decisions, but you're not bringing people along. What did he say, and what did that do for you as sort of an emerging leader in your – you must have been in your early, mid-30s at the time.
Early 30s. So at age 32, President Clinton and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright appointed me Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. I was a very young African-American woman. I just had a baby. I was breastfeeding still as I took on that job. And many of the most senior people who reported to me and the ambassadors who reported to me were 20 to 30 years my senior. And in a State Department that at that point and still to a substantial extent today is very male and very white male. And so it was a little bit of oil and water at the beginning because I was a hard-charging political appointee. I wanted to get stuff done. I knew I had the backing of the president and the secretary. We had a very clear-cut agenda. And then we faced a number of wars and other crises, terrorist attacks in my first year in 1998. And I was just pushing to get as much done and drive through the difficulties and the pain. Not actually in a dissimilar way than I did as a child through my parents' divorce. The harder things got, the more determined I became to just get through. And what Howard Wolpe did was extraordinary. I mean, he provided me tough love, which is the title of the book because it's how my parents raised me. It's how I've tried to raise my kids. And it's also how I've tried to manage teams and serve our country. Howard gave me tough love. He was a former congressman from Michigan, very experienced, very senior, who was serving in the State Department as a special envoy for President Clinton. He took me out and said, look, Susan, you're going to fail if you don't figure out how to be more patient, if you're not more, inclusive and respectful of others in your leadership style. He took me to the woodshed, but he did it in the spirit of trying to help me succeed. And I recognized, as tough as it was in the moment, that he was giving me an extraordinary gift. And it helped me to change course and it helped me to improve as a leader and a manager, such that by the end of my tenure, I think I'd turned around a lot of those relationships and come out successful and far more respected than I certainly was early in my tenure at the State Department.
Well, I'm sure you faced a lot of tough questions there. We're going to take a few from our listeners now. I'd like to go first to Livermore, Kentucky. Danny, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
My question to Ms. Rice is, given the current state of our national security under this current administration, what assurances, Ms. Rice, can you give to the American people as a whole that we what would be done after he does leave office eventually? How are we going to avoid further damage to our national security, given the fact that he's very, opinionated on Twitter? I can take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Danny. Thanks for listening. What do you say, Susan Rice?
Danny, that's a vital question because when there is new leadership in the White House, there's going to be so much damage to repair. The first and most important order of business in the national security sphere is to repair our relationships with our allies and partners and give them confidence again that we will stand by our word, we'll stand by our commitments, we'll speak the truth, and that we understand that our national security is linked up to their national security. It's not a zero-sum world that we live in. It's a world in which what is good for our allies and partners is good for us. And we face all kinds of serious challenges, whether from Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, that we can only effectively tackle with partners. And so there's going to be a great deal of need to try to restore and renew those relationships that have suffered so much in recent years.
I'd like to take a call. It's also from Columbia, South Carolina. Dania is calling in. Thanks for listening, Dania.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to point out that I think it's extremely disturbing that usually when we hear conversations from foreign policy experts in American politics, it's so clear that we place a lower value on the lives of non-Americans compared to Americans. And I think it just blows my mind that in a region that we have been so responsible for destabilizing, that we could then think there's any legitimacy in shifting the burden of the fighting and the violence onto the people who have suffered the most as a result of American actions. And I just can't understand how we think that we could ever build trust with anyone when our conversations about strategy are designed in this way and talked about like this.
Thank you for that question, Dania. Susan Rice, let's ask about that. When you're kind of formulating national security objectives and national security tactics, you know, approaches to it, what is the emphasis you put on American lives versus the emphasis you put on those of allies or folks elsewhere?
Well, obviously, David, the President of the United States is bound by his oath in the Constitution to protect and defend the United States of America. But I was privileged to work for two presidents who understood that the best way to do that is to value and respect and support countries and peoples around the world. Again, not a zero-sum mindset of America first or America alone or America versus the rest of the world, but America with partners. And that is why we stood up in all kinds of fora, and I did as UN ambassador for human rights, for democracy, for human dignity, for the basic equality of all human beings, you know, where regardless of their race, their religion, their sexual orientation. That is the work that I did proudly on behalf of the United States and on behalf of President Obama, because he believed profoundly that we are all human beings. We are all of equal worth and value in the most basic sense in God's eyes, if that's how you choose to look at it. And we can't effectively lead if people believe around the world that we have no regard or respect for the dignity of other human beings. And that's unfortunately, I think, too often the message we're conveying today, because we're not standing up for values and democracy and human rights. And we're throwing under the bus partners like the Kurds who sacrificed with us and for us in service of a larger mission.
Sure.
And now
sure.
We've let them drop.
Susan Rice, we have a couple minutes left before the end of this segment. You know, you write a little bit about what it was to be a young woman rising in the diplomatic corps, in the State Department hierarchy. You felt there were moments you were patronized even by some of those who were looking out for you, had your best interest at heart, as well as by those who might not have so much. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, the late diplomat, at one point aggrieved you so much you gave him the bird, and I don't mean the American bald eagle. tell us a little bit about what inspired you on that.
Well, as I write it in the book, Ambassador Holbrooke, as talented a diplomat as he was also, frankly, a bully. And mm-hmm. as he told me in our first encounter, he already disliked me because I had broken his record as the youngest regional assistant secretary of state. I'd never met him before, and he camped out in my office to convey that message. And frankly, our relationship went downhill from there.
Not so diplomatic with his colleagues.
No, not at least not me. And actually many others, I think it's fair to say. My parents raised me to believe in myself and to not take crap off of anybody. That was my father's mantra. Don't take crap off of anybody, meaning don't let anybody dismiss you, denigrate you, treat you badly and get away with it. And so in a particular encounter that I describe in the book where Ambassador Holbrooke tries to humiliate me in front of my team, and is very condescending and says to me, I dripping with sarcasm, I remember when I, too, was a young assistant secretary and he was putting me down to try to win an argument. I responded with a nonverbal gesture.
Is that what it's called?
that conveyed my
disdain. So what did you achieve by doing that?
I don't know that I achieved anything other than letting him know that he wasn't going to just walk on me
in
front of my team. He didn't treat me any worse or any better. Bullies roll over people when they think they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. I was letting him know that with me, he wasn't going to get away with it. And funnily, I had the support and the backing of my boss, the Secretary of State, and the National Security Advisor, who
always
understood
helps.
How
always
he rolled
helps.
And how I roll.
We're in conversation with Susan Rice discussing her personal journey, her distinguished professional career at the top levels of the nation's foreign policy establishment. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for my guest? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. My guest this hour, Susan Rice. She's a top foreign policy advisor to President Obama for his entire 8 years in office. Ended up being the national security advisor. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, as I say, Susan Rice. She's written a new memoir. It's out this week. It's called Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Susan Rice, I want to take on an episode that you got attached to fairly strongly by the president's political opponents in Congress, one that you became in some ways the public face on. That's about Benghazi. In September 2012, there was a terrorist attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya. That attack took the life of U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other American citizens. Susan Rice, you were assigned to articulate the U.S. government's explanation of what happened in a whirlwind of interviews on the five major Sunday television public affairs shows. Here you were on CBS's Face the Nation.
It began spontaneously in Benghazi as a reaction to what had transpired some hours earlier in Cairo, where, of course, as you know, there was a violent protest outside of our embassy sparked by this hateful video.
Now, I got to say, Susan Rice, I have a number of questions for you about this episode, and I want to get to even the TV element of it in a moment. But first, I want to clarify for listeners. It's been a few years. There's been a lot of talk and hot talk takes on this. What you said there was not really our understanding ultimately of what happened in Benghazi. What really happened there to start with?
Well, actually, the message that I conveyed, the so-called talking points, which were produced by our intelligence community on September 16th, was the best information that we had at the time. And it was information that I explained on each of the shows was preliminary and could change as the investigation unfolded. What happened, David, ultimately, to make a long story short, is about 7 to 10 days after I appeared on the Sunday shows, the intelligence community updated its assessment of what had happened. And in the meantime, I was accused of lying to the American people, deliberately misleading the American people as to what had actually happened. In fact, I was sharing what we knew at the time. That information changed. And that David has been validated by 8 congressional committees who investigated Benghazi, including the last one and the most politicized one led by Trey Gowdy. None of those investigations concluded that I had deliberately misled the American people. But what happened was that the information ultimately that I provided turned out to be wrong in one critical respect. There was no demonstration outside of our diplomatic facility in Benghazi. And what happened was that armed militia, armed men, stormed our facilities with heavy weapons, and most importantly and most tragically, took the lives of 4 Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, who were serving on the U.S. government's behalf in Benghazi. And the real tragedy of all of this, in addition to losing those patriotic Americans, was that the politicization of the Benghazi terrorist attack and the attacks on me and later on Secretary Clinton and others overshadowed their loss and overshadowed the real question, which is, you know, how do we work to prevent such things in the future? And it also chilled Washington on any interest in helping to stabilize a Libya that had been fractured following Gaddafi's removal.
Mm-hmm. Why did you become the public face of that? I mean, you did what is called in Washington the full Ginsburg, which is a reference to Monica Lewinsky's lawyer back in the impeachment days in the late 90s. But the idea being you flooded the zone. It was you. You became the public face of the administration for this. But as you write in your book, you really weren't the decision maker on this. You weren't the one who was making calls. And in fact, as ultimately even rather hostile investigations by Republicans in Congress showed, it wasn't as though there were conscious decisions to abandon people there. This was an attack that overwhelmed people. So why were you the one?
Absolutely not any deliberate effort on anybody's part in the administration. And Congress did find that. I write about this actually rather extensively in Tough Love. You know, it was a Sunday that came about 10 days before the opening of the United Nations General Assembly, where leaders were coming to New York, where I was ambassador, to deal with a whole range of issues. And on that Sunday, the expectation was that the discussion on the shows would be not only about Benghazi, but about the demonstrations that had hit our embassies around the Arab and Muslim world. It would also be about Iran and other issues related to the General Assembly. I was asked on a Friday afternoon by the White House if I would go on those Sunday talk shows. And it was explained to me when I asked that Secretary Clinton or the National Security Advisor, who would have been obvious candidates, that Secretary Clinton had declined to go on, that she had had an exhausting and emotionally, you know, difficult week, obviously, with the loss of our personnel, and she declined. And the White House was asking me if I'd be a good soldier and go out and do it. And I had no plans to spend my weekend doing that. I was actually planning to take my kids to Ohio State for a football game, their first Big Ten game. And I did that actually on Saturday because I didn't want to break that commitment to them. But I nonetheless came back and agreed to do the Sunday shows. As I write in the book, it was sort of half funny and half tragic. My mother, who'd been quite ill but was still sharp as tacks,
yeah, she wasn't telling you to go be a good soldier, right? Shows.
She told me not to be a good soldier. She told me not to go on the show. She had an instinct that was more prescient than mine that this would not end well. But I was, frankly, doing what I have always done throughout my career, which is to be a team player. And I said yes. I wasn't happy to do it, but I wasn't, you know, unwilling to do it. And that decision to put the mission and the team first ended up in this instance backfiring on me.
You write in the book a little bit about talking to a former Fox News producer who say, hey, look, you know, if you're going to be on TV, Fox and other conservative outfits are going to have video on you forever. And everyone needs a face of a villain to make the emblem of something that they certainly wanted to turn very much into a scandal. You mentioned Secretary Clinton. You had actually worked, as we talked about earlier, in the Clinton administration under President Bill Clinton. And then you were approached by Hillary Clinton in 2008 to be, I think, her advisor on African affairs for her campaign with the eye towards the white. Is that wrong?
No,
is that
sorry,
not right? Tell me.
David, just to clarify, I'd worked 8 years in the Clinton administration, yeah. Was very proud to do it, and worked in various different capacities, but mostly on Africa. Then fast forward to 2007, leading into the 2008 campaign. At that point, I had committed to join President Obama's campaign effort. But shortly after I'd made that commitment to President Obama, I was asked by a former national security advisor on behalf of Secretary Clinton if I would play a leadership role in coordinating her national security apparatus, not just on Africa, but
more
everything
generally
for her campaign. And I had to acknowledge that I, with thanks and appreciation, that I'd already committed to be playing a similar role for Barack Obama.
And it seemed as though you wanted a fresh generation, a new thing. But you talk a little bit about race defining the way in which you were careful. You seemed very committed to expanding America's investment involvement in Africa and at the same time not wanting to be pigeonholed as a black woman simply as an expert in such areas.
Well, that was the very beginning of my career. We're now going back from 2007, 2008 to really about 1993, mm-hmm. where I was 28 years old and I was first offered I was offered my first job in government, and it was to be able to come on the National Security Council staff and work on African affairs. It's a subject that I was always interested in, I've written my dissertation on, that I cared deeply about. But I chose in the first instance not to accept a job working on African affairs as a 28-year-old African-American woman because I was concerned, rightly or wrongly, that I might find myself pigeonholed in Africa and viewed as unable or incapable of working on a broader set of issues. And so with more than a little chutzpah, I think, in retrospect, I respectfully declined that offer. They came back to me and offered me a different job, and that was to be working on the National Security Council staff on UN affairs and peacekeeping. That was a global brief, and I thought that that was a good place to start. And I was very proud to be able to serve in that role initially. But then, after a couple of years, after I'd established myself as having the capacity to work on a wide range of regions and issues, when offered a job to lead the Africa office at the NSC and later to be the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, I proudly accepted.
Ben Rhodes, the former Deputy National Security Advisor to Barack Obama, has said about you, quote, "She determined early on as an African-American woman that she couldn't just be like everyone else. She had to find her own voice. And if she wasn't going to be invited into the room, she was going to have to kick down the door." I believe we have a call from Portland, Maine about public service and Ambassador Susan Rice. Constantine, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Mr. Folkenflik, and hello to Ambassador Rice as well. Yes, there was talk for a while there and that Ambassador Rice was going to challenge Susan Collins as a Democrat for her Senate seat. And although I respect her decision not to run, it's clearly Maine's loss because at this juncture in time, we really need a leader right now. And also, Mr. Folkenflik, you'd be pleased to know that a friend of mine, I babysat a friend of mine's kid over the summer, and he was here a lot at my work on Fridays, and now every time we turn on NPR, he announces, "And now this news."
Love that, Constantine. And as your friend, young friend, will be happy to know, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Ambassador Rice, what about it? What about the people of Maine? You decided not to run. I think you announced that last year. You know, Susan Collins, a moderate Republican, but you know, every seat counts for the Democrats' team. What made you decide you didn't want to go through that that process or that rigor?
Well, first of all, my greetings to the folks in Maine and Constantine in Portland. I have great affection and deep roots in Maine because of my mother and my mother's family that have been in Maine since 1912, and I continue to be a proud homeowner in Maine. And I thought very seriously last year after, particularly after Senator Collins decided to support Brett Kavanaugh, which I think will be proved to be an extraordinary mistake and tragedy, that I thought very seriously about running. And I looked into it and I consulted with my family and I sort of searched my soul. And I decided that now was not the time for me personally to make such a run, primarily because my husband and I have one more child at home, a daughter going who is now in her junior year in high school. And I knew that if I were to make this run, I would have to either leave her back in Washington in school or take her out of school and move at a very sort of sensitive and critical moment for her to put her in school up in Maine. And, you know, I spent 4.5 years, David, in New York, away from my children, away from my husband when I was UN ambassador. They stayed in Washington. And then I spent another 3.5 years working insane hours at the White House. And I decided that this was a time when I really needed to not put more pressure and strain on my family and not abuse their generosity in supporting me so generously over all these years of my service.
You mentioned your family. You talk a little bit about your son's evolution from a Denis Kucinich-loving liberal, left-of-center liberal, to his role now. He's a student at Stanford, John Rice Cameron, I believe.
You call him Jake
in the book. And yet, he wears a red hat, at least metaphorically. He wants to make Stanford great again, head of the
Only
Stanford.
Only metaphorically. It wouldn't last very long in our household.
Well, head of the Stanford College Republicans. You know, I guess one way to ask the question is, how do you seek to convince, you know, somebody who's sort of in the MAGA camp at the moment politically within your own family as well as your own community?
Look, just to be precise, my son Jake, who's now a senior in college, is a traditional conservative. There have been some articles that have characterized him as a MAGA wearing hat-wearing guy. I think that's not entirely accurate, but he is a traditional conservative whose views differ markedly from mine and my husband's and daughter's. You know, my husband and I raised two children that we taught to think independently and to have the courage of their convictions. And that's how my parents raised me. And I'm really proud that we've got two kids, one who's quite progressive and one who's quite conservative. But they both took that lesson to heart, for better or for worse.
So rounding us out in terms of the hour, we've got about 45 seconds, a minute left. Use that metaphorically. How do you talk to somebody who may seem so sharply polarized it's hard to reach? You have experience in your own home. How do you do it?
The most important thing, David, is to be respectful, to listen, to try to understand their perspective, and to not dismiss it as invalid or unworthy of consideration. And that's what we have to do, not only in our families where we may have differences, but it's what we've got to do on a national basis where our divisions threaten to rip us apart and cause us to disintegrate as a democracy and as a unitary country from within. We've got to look to one another and recognize that we have so much more that unites us as Americans than divides us over the basis of politics or policy.
A familiar phrase from Susan Rice. She's former national security advisor, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Obama administration, now the author of the brand new memoir, Tough Love, My Story, The Things Worth Fighting For and Things Worth Talking About This Hour. Susan Rice, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Great to be with you.
You can continue the conversation. Again, the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Mylena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Line, David Marino, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer, that's Karen Schiffman, me. I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.